Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Francis Fukuyama was a big dog in the pack of neoconservatives that pushed for years for the U.S. to get tough on Saddam Hussein. The celebrated author of The End of History was a big-name thinker in the neocon clubhouse. Now, Francis Fukuyama is bailing out. Somewhere, he says, the neocons went off the rails. And this longtime neocon tells us where. The war in Iraq was wrong, he says. The chest-puffing embrace of preemptive war, wrong. The comparison of Saddam Hussein to Hitler and the war on terror to World War II, wrong. Now, says Fukuyama, we have unleashed the maelstrom. Up next on Point, Francis Fukuyama and the legacy of neoconservatism. Joining me now is Francis Fukuyama, professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University. His influential 1992 book, The End of History and the Last Man, was published to enormous critical acclaim, scandalously brilliant, is how Charles Krauthammer, a once close fellow neocon, put it. We'll hear more about their rift in a moment. Francis Fukuyama's new book is America at the Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy. Francis Fukuyama, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Fukuyama.
Hi.
Francis Fukuyama, what's the maelstrom that's been unleashed?
Well, I think that the Bush Doctrine, which brought together ideas like preventive war, a certain kind of unilateralism, and the argument that democracy was lack of democracy was the source of terrorism, and therefore the Middle East needed a broad political transformation. These were the animating ideas in the first 4 years of the Bush administration, and I think every single one of them has led to a serious problem. The preventive war, I think, was based on this idea that you could foresee the future 3, 4, 5 years down the road, and as we saw with the missing weapons of mass destruction, that foresight was not forthcoming. I think the unilateralism and the manner in which the Bush administration treated the rest of the world, given the background of anti-Americanism that's out there right now, has led to an unprecedented isolation of the United States. And I think that I'm still very much in favor, I think, of the broad agenda of promoting democracy. But I think that the link to terrorism or that the promotion of democracy as a means of solving our terrorism problem is a very questionable one, and I think also was mishandled in the actual implementation of the transition to a post-Saddam Iraq in a way that has really, in a sense, shifted the initiative over to Islamists and other people that are really not either liberal or democratic in the Middle East.
We're going to look at that, but what happened here? I mean, you were on the train, you were on the boat, 1998, you put right in the beginning of your book. You signed a letter, along with others, neocons, at the Project for the New American Century to President Clinton, saying be tougher on Saddam Hussein. Here we are, not that many years later, and you're jumping off the boat. What was the shift? What happened?
Well, it really came about in the year prior to the war. I had signed those letters, but I started thinking very carefully about the long-term strategy towards the war on terrorism and the nature of the threat, which I concluded was primarily a political one rather than a military one. I also started thinking very hard about the American ability to handle these complex nation-building projects. We've tried a lot of this since, well, actually the first one was the American reconstruction of the South after the Civil War, but going through the Philippines and all of the Latin American, Caribbean interventions. And it seemed to me that we really did suffer. We weren't a really imperial people, and we got tired of these projects fairly easily. And the Bush administration on the eve of the Iraq War had really not done, I thought, remotely enough to prepare the American people for the 5, 10, 15-year commitment that this kind of a project might require. And so that was really, I think, the reason that I decided that this the invasion constituted a roll of the dice that might work, but the odds, I think, were just not in our favor.
You described this moment in 2004. Of course, that's well after the invasion in Iraq, where you were listening to your longtime fellow neoconservative Charles Krauthammer, he who described your end of history work as scandalously brilliant. You heard him talking about where the country was headed, where the response to the 9/11 attacks had taken us, and you just couldn't take it. What was it about his interpretation of that moment?
Well, that's right. This was in February of 2004, and so the war was almost a year old. They had not found weapons of mass destruction, so our credibility was really undermined. The insurgency had started up big time, and he was really talking about the entire policy as if it were an unqualified success. And I guess just watching the people applauding around me made me suddenly realize that I was living in some, you know, different universe than the one that they were in, and that they simply were not taking into account realities about the outside world that I thought were plainly evident, that we weren't handling things well and that the way the world was reacting to us simply did not regard us as a legitimate, you know, benevolent hegemon, in the words of Bill Kristol and Bob Kagan, who had tried, and also Krauthammer himself, who had talked about the unipolar moment and the need of the United States to use its power in this fashion.
Let's be clear about what you're saying here. Are you then, just to be plain about it, are you saying, yes, the neocons took the wheel with George W. Bush's first presidency, and yes, the neocons drove the country in the wrong direction, into a ditch? Are you pinning this group of intellectuals, thought leaders?
No, absolutely not.
You're not? It sounds like you are. I mean,
well, it's very difficult to disentangle the public arguments that were made by supporters of the war, neoconservative supporters of the war. There were a number in the administration, and then there were people like Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary Rumsfeld in the Pentagon, who are not known as neoconservatives, who, and I think it's really those latter two principles that were the main drivers of the Iraq policy. And I think until people do their memoirs and we really sort out why they believed, you know, what they believed, we will not know what the actual impact of the neoconservatives was. One thing I think is really important for people to understand, people act as if neoconservatism is some kind of alien spore that drifted from outer space and landed on the United States and produced this strange fruit. And in fact, there's a, you know, sometimes this comes with a tinge of anti-Semitism, which I think is very wrong. I think that many of the ideas that neoconservatives hold are actually as American as apple pie. Spreading democracy is a Wilsonian idea. It's very a deep theme in American foreign policy, as is the idea that military power can be used for moral purposes, which I think is also something that many Americans believe. And so the neoconservatives, I think, took a number of ideas that have roots in American politics. They put them together in a particular package that was different from Kissinger realists or liberal internationalists. But I don't think that they can be blamed for creating or certainly not exclusively blamed for creating the Iraq war policy.
We'll look at that. They're pushing back pretty hard, some, on your point right now. Victor Davis Hanson writing about the Great Stampede. He looks at you and William F. Buckley and Neil Ferguson and George Will and maybe Andrew Sullivan, he might have named as well, as conservatives, neocons, who have turned on the Iraq war and says, hey, you know, you got us in here. Now you're just getting wobbly when the going gets tough.
Well, I was wobbly before the war started, so yeah. I mean, he's right. He's right in that respect. But you know, I guess the question is at a point like this. Well, first of all, look, I agree with him. I'm not calling for an immediate withdrawal. I think now that we've gotten in here, we really do have an obligation to see this through. And I don't really see a good alternative to the kind of slow turnover of authority to the new Iraqi state that the president has put forward. And so I'm not going wobbly in that sense. But I do think that when you have what I think is going to end up a fairly big foreign policy setback when this sort of thing happens, I do think that it calls for a certain amount of reflection about how we got into this position and looking at a lot of the first principles that the policy was based on. And, you know, that was really why I reacted in the way I did to the Krauthammer speech, is that there was just no admission that reality was at all different from the way that it had been projected prior to the mm-hmm. war. And I think that inability to adjust to reality is the hallmark of ideology rather than, you know, I think, wise statesmanship. Mm-hmm.
Jack Beattie, here's Francis Fukuyama sitting back on his heels saying, wait a minute, this is looking pretty bad. I can't call myself a neocon anymore. Let's take another look at all this.
Well, one can understand why he wouldn't want to do that. You know, he says that he was wobbly before the war started, but on our very first program on the air, Tom, I quoted a letter sent by a group of American intellectuals, including Professor Fukuyama, to the president, urging saying failure to undertake an effort to remove Saddam from power will constitute an early and perhaps decisive surrender in the war on international terrorism. And I went on to say why I thought that was, in the context of jihadi terrorism against the United States, why that would perhaps be a catastrophic step. But Mr. Fukuyama doesn't mention that letter in his book. He mentions the one from 1998 when it was merely a bad idea. But by 2001, it was worse than that. It was clear that, and in fact, Michael Howard, the British military thinker, said an attack on Iraq in the context of jihadi terrorism against the West would be equivalent to a nuclear exchange in the Cold War. And I quoted that in our first program.
Francis Fukuyama, Jack Beattie says, there's a lot to talk about here, but wait a minute. Your name was on a letter well after 1998 saying, regime change, please. What about that?
That letter was signed, I think, about 9 days after September 11th. And I spent, the months after that thinking very hard about this. I don't think that I need to apologize for having a difficult time weighing the competing moral goods on the side of intervention and non-intervention. The United Nations has just come up with a doctrine about the duty to protect, and I think that there is a serious moral good on the other side that had to do with, when you have the power to deal with a dictator like Saddam Hussein, if you fail to act on that, you are somehow complicit with those kinds of human rights violations. And so it was a very difficult thing. And part of the reason that I didn't say more publicly in the months prior to the war was I actually had the opportunity to brief a lot of this privately to people in the administration in the course of a study that I had been asked to do, a Pentagon study. So,
and what were you telling them? Go to Baghdad or not? At that point?
No. I mean, it was just the opposite. I mean, almost all of the ideas that are in my current book are really ones that I formulated in the course of doing the study about the basically political nature of the struggle ahead, and therefore the political tools that one would need and the need if you were going to go into Iraq to at least be prepared for a long and difficult occupation with a lot of thought to, the long-term requirements for rebuilding a democratic system.
But your name was on the 2001 letter. What are your friends saying
Bill
to you
Crystal
now? Are they saying, Frank, what are you doing here? You were with us, and now it's too easy to throw stones.
Mm-hmm.
Are they? Well, are you getting that?
Obviously, I'm getting that from the Wall Street Journal and from places like that. But I do think that there's also a certain amount of sympathy, because I do think that, any thoughtful person looking back at these events would have to say that the world actually didn't work quite in the way that was predicted.
Please go ahead. We're interested.
Well, no, I just have the feeling that, with a lot of other neoconservatives who haven't really said anything terribly much lately, there's a hope that things in Iraq will, there'll be a deus ex machina that will turn things around there and make the whole project, vindicate the whole project in the end. But I think that if that doesn't happen, there will be a further accounting.
Praying for that hand of God. Let's turn to our listeners. Imran's calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. My question for the professor is that, has there been a change in, I guess, the fundamental assumptions about the Middle East? And I think where I'm going with this is that the professor had mentioned that neocons had been characterized, at least some of them, around the idea of maybe there's an anti-Semitic bent. But I would actually argue that the neocons were probably more characterized by an anti-Arabism. And if you read the writings of people like Victor Davis Hanson or Bernard Lewis, who actually had the ear of the administration, there was always this kind of theme that, you know, Arabs only understood power, and the only way to get them to comply or see your way was by a demonstration of that power. And I was wondering if maybe there's been if the professor has come to see a change in that.
In himself or in others, Imran?
Well, in himself, but also in others, because I think that, you know, this has been the operating assumption all along, was that, you know, these people are, the Arabs, I guess, in particular, are, you know, are irrational, and, you know, according to Davis Hanson, you know, they're slothful, and they spend their time playing backgammon and all sorts of kind of...
So let's lay down the law with some Tomahawk missiles and show them what's what.
Right. Yeah, and I'd like to know if there's been maybe a sea change in that attitude.
Mr. Fukuyama.
Well, you know, one of the core arguments in my current book is that it's really an analysis of where radical Islamism comes from, and the answer is it's really, in a sense, a confrontation with modernization, and it comes out of modernity in a certain way, not out of anything like a traditional Islam or Muslim culture. I think that neocons are divided on this, but there is definitely that kind of anti-Arab or this view that Arabs really only understand force. This was particularly true, I think, with Krauthammer, and actually in my first version of this article I published that was a critique of that speech that he gave at the American Enterprise Institute, I quoted him on a number of occasions. He said in a debate once with John Mearsheimer that if you want to get to the Arabs' hearts and minds, you had to grab a different part of their anatomy and squeeze as hard as you could. And it just seemed to me that for him to then argue that you know, Iraq could be democratized, if that was really the respect with which he held, you know, Arab political culture, it just seemed quite wildly inconsistent. And so I do think that there is an element of that. But I don't think it is universally held. I think that there are other people that, you know, regard the Arab world as part of a, you know, they genuinely are democratic universalists to the point of, I think, in fact, being a little bit naive on the other side, that Arabs want democracy much as Poles or Romanians or people in Eastern Europe.
But let me ask you, I read you saying, Francis Fukuyama, that in the event, the way the Bush administration has acted on some of these neocon principles or their inspiration has actually turned the Islamic world into something it didn't need to be, has blown this up into a real kind of war of cultures that didn't have to exist.
Well, it's hard to know how this would have developed, but it does seem to me that there was always a danger of escalating what should have properly been a struggle with a very narrow extremist ideology represented by a pretty small minority in the Muslim world into something that they could portray as a broad assault on the religion, Islam, and the culture and beliefs of you know, a billion people around the world. And I do think that the you know, the site of an Arab capital, a major Arab capital occupied by American troops fighting domestic resistance has actually been a huge recruiting poster for a lot of jihadists around the world, and it's made it much more plausible for people to argue that this is a more of a clash of civilizations rather than a targeted struggle against an extremist doctrine.
And in that, the neocons, being put in, not finally to a solution, but to bringing on, in your word, the maelstrom.
That's right. I think that again, if their version of reality had proven to be true, that you had the intervention followed by the discovery of nuclear weapons, you know, an ongoing nuclear weapons program, followed by a relatively rapid Eastern European-style transition to a stable democracy, you know, I think the opinion in the Arab world might have gone the other way, where this democratic wave would have had a demonstration, a positive demonstration effect. And you know, to be honest, in places like Egypt, it really has opened up a space for public discussion that didn't exist before. But I think the problem is that once Iraq got bogged down and that didn't seem like such a great example, that people in Iran or Syria that were anti-regime and really wanted democracy took a look at Iraq and they said, well, if this is what regime change means, then let's stick with, you know, the familiar, what we got until conditions get better.
Jack Beatty, how about it? Okay, there's history. There's the letter in 2001. Now Francis Fukuyama says, wrong war, preemption, wrong strategy, and the Bush administration's portrayal of the threat, wrong portrayal, bringing on the maelstrom. Are you shoulder to shoulder with Professor Fukuyama now, Jack?
Yes, I think he makes a lot of good points here. But again, these are points that critics of this venture made at the start, made before the war, made when this was foreseeable and by them foreseen. And so it's good to hear him saying these things. And as I repeat, it would have been better to hear him saying that in real time. You know, I think he's both too easy on the neoconservatives and too hard. Too easy because he brushes past the evidence of deception, if not by neocons, then by people allied with them in government. For example, he says the intelligence community had every incentive to overestimate the Iraqi WMD threat in 2003 because it had underestimated the threat in 1990. And did not want to be fooled again. Well, wait a minute. We know what happened with that estimate. We have Paul Pilar's testimony, the head of the CIA group out there, that this intelligence was manipulated and fricasseed and pickled in prejudice toward the war. And you know, and the administration spent how long implicating Saddam in 9/11 in the same sentence? Bush would say, you know, Saddam, and then he'd end the sentence with, I mean, if that isn't deception. And then we have Doug Fife's, you know, he's one of these neoconservatives. He's the director of this Office of Special Plans that's part of this cabal, Lawrence Wilkerson says. So, you know, that's being too easy on them. I think too hard is, to an intellectual ideas drive history. Well, yes and no. I mean, domestic politics, we can't take that out of account. 2002 was an election year. Karl Rove was going to have an election issue. We know that when Don Rumsfeld said there aren't enough things to bomb in Afghanistan, well, the implication was we can't keep this war going. We need something else. Then there's oil and new bases. After all, we did have Paul Wolfowitz saying, oh, gee, you know, we just came up with that WMD because we could agree on it bureaucratically. The real motive here is we needed new bases to protect our oil. And then just simply with the point that Imran made, the kind of implicit racism here. And I think you saw some of it or a hint of it in President Bush in the debate in 2004 when he said, after all, they attacked us. They, Iraq, hardly.
Francis Fukuyama, how about it? You're too easy and too hard.
I mean, every single one of those points, I think, is debatable and could be picked apart. I agree that the most dishonest thing that the administration did in the lead-up to the war was tying Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda. I mean, to this day, something like 70% of the soldiers serving out there think that they're avenging September 11th, and that, I think, was quite deliberate, and they knew better. On the WMD, I really do not think that they were lying if by lying they said to themselves in the privacy of their offices, yes, we know that these programs don't exist, but we're going to, you know, fabricate the evidence and put it forward. They believed that everybody at that point believed that the bio and chemical weapons stockpiles were there. There was a big debate over the nuclear program based on fairly slender evidence, but the people that, you know, put that evidence forward, you know, believe with certainty that even if the program wasn't in existence, that it would start up the moment sanctions were lifted.
And Paul Pilar saying the intelligence was tortured to support this view?
Well, I think that he was talking, I mean, he's a friend of mine. We've talked about this at great length. I think that, you know, he in particular is talking about the effort to see links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, where there was a constant effort to come up with, you know, supporting evidence, this Prague meeting with Mohammed Atta, and the intelligence community alleged, kept coming back and saying, you know, there just isn't anything to that. But, you know, the actual reality that they didn't even have stocks of chemical weapons, I think, is something that absolutely surprised everybody in the intelligence community. And so that, you know, to lay that at the feet of the administration, I think, is not is not really fair. On the question of oil, I think that that is quite unfair, actually, to Paul Wolfowitz. I mean, he's of all of the people in the administration, he is the one, I think, that took most seriously the idealistic component. And actually, in that interview, I think he was talking about that, that that was, you know, his real reason, but that the WMD was something that other people could agree with. The oil...
A little honesty would have been nice to let Americans decide not on the basis of a mushroom cloud, but on his neocon ideology in that case, would it not?
Well, perhaps, but that idealistic argument, you know, was one of the ones that was put forward. Mm. The, you know, the oil argument, I think the conspiratorial view is just wrong. The idea that somehow this was the oil lobby that was pushing for this agenda. I mean, they would have been perfectly happy to have sanctions lifted on Saddam Hussein because they can buy oil from him as well as anyone else. You don't need to go to war over that. I think there was a strategic view that you didn't want this big stream of revenue going into the funding of WMD, terrorism, wars against neighbors, and the like. And that, you know, it seems to me is quite a reasonable concern to have.
Do two things for us. First, I mean, in broad terms, quantify how serious is the hit, then, in your view, that we've taken by following this neocon beam? And second, what are you prescribing now? What's the turn, the change?
Well, the hit, I think, is pretty substantial, but it's very hard to quantify. There's obviously been a big increase in anti-Americanism. It takes an especially dangerous turn in the Middle East because this becomes an active recruiting source for other terrorists that want to go to Iraq, that want to fight the United States. Now, that existed before the Iraq War, but I do think that as a result of that, we have made that worse. In other parts of the world, including in Western Europe, among some of our very close allies, it has created a tremendous anti-Americanism across the board. You know, they don't like our social policy, our economic policies, and particularly our foreign policy. Now, it's true that the governments continue to work with us on many fronts, but I do think that we crossed a kind of watershed with Iraq. You know, the month before the war started, in February of 2003, there were organized demonstrations all over Europe against the war, and many people said that was the only issue in which Europeans all spontaneously agreed. And in a sense, some people, in fact, called it the birth of Europe. That was the birth of the European nation. And so I think that was a Rubicon. And you know, Europeans are not going to oppose us openly on many things, but I think there's a process now of soft balancing going on where we're simply going in different directions. I think that what you do now is very difficult. It's going to take a very long time to get out of this this hole or this kind of isolation that we've created for ourselves. It requires, I think, reversing some of the policies of the past. Obviously, until you wind down Iraq and hopefully wind it down in a way that leaves a reasonably stable government in place, that's going to continue to be a burr, you know, big burr under the saddle. I think we need a very different attitude towards international organizations and how we legitimate our action in the future, because I think that coalitions of the willing are just not... you know, they aren't good enough. Coalitions of the willing is just a euphemism, I think, for American unilateralism. And I think we need to think seriously about a different kind of world order. I don't think it can really ever be based solely on the United Nations, because that organization is just too weak to handle a lot of important situations. But I think we need to seriously construct a different kind of world in which you have overlapping, sometimes competing organizations that can offer alternative venues for international collective action. So that's you know, another piece, I think, that needs to be put in place.
Multilateral, multinational institutions. There's Francis Fukuyama. His book is America at the Crossroads, and you can hear getting pretty far off the neocon ranch there. Leo's calling from Buffalo, New York. Leo, what do you think?
Well, I think quite a lot of things. I think that, for one thing, the Muslim insurgencies that are currently attacking more than a dozen nations around the world have all been underway since before the term neocon was coined, since before Bush was ever in office or was ever a candidate for office. and since well before 9/11 or our actions in Iraq. And, you know, I think that comparing it to World War II is really quite appropriate, especially when we see on the ground that what they mean when they all say they're going to purge corruption from the land is the literal meaning of corruption in the land that the Sharia defines as anybody who owns land or manages land and isn't Muslim. Basically, all of these insurgencies promised exactly what happened to the Sudan. I wonder how you could disavow the facts on the ground and the world perspective that shows so many nations under attack at the same time by the same people with the same rhetoric.
Leo, let us pick it up. Francis Fukuyama, there's a challenge saying Bush and co. didn't create this. It was already bubbling along, and let's stare at it.
No, that's absolutely right. Bush did not create radical Islamism. But I think that you really need to pick apart exactly where this thing comes from. And this is, you know, it's a longer argument than I think we have time for. But I really think that in many ways, so many of the terrorists were actually radicalized in Western Europe in the heart of existing liberal democracies. And I think the reason for that is that the radicalization responds to a kind of alienation that is created when you are not actually a traditional Muslim. You're no longer living in a little village in Morocco or Turkey or wherever, but you're also not integrated into a Western society. And then along comes Osama bin Laden, who gives you this very pure doctrine, who actually takes imports a lot of ideas from extremist ideologies of the West, from fascism and from Leninism, in the 20th century. And that, I think, is really what we are facing. To say that this was somehow mandated in the Sharia or by some very deeply rooted Islamic beliefs, I think, just disregards a lot of world history, because Islam, like any other world religion, can be interpreted in many ways, sometimes in an extreme form and sometimes in a much more easygoing manner. And, you know, just 70 years ago, I think if you looked at the world and said, well, where are Jews safer, in the Muslim Middle East or in Europe, it would have been the Muslim Middle East. So, you know, these things are complicated. But I do agree that radical Islam is a real danger. It is something that was not created by the Bush administration. I just think that we need to, in fighting it, fight it with policies that actually get at the hardcore of the extremists, rather than, in a way, doing their work for them by acts that build their argument that this is, in fact, a clash of civilizations, which it really is not.
And the World War II metaphor, your warning, boosts that view of the clash of civilizations.
I think that thinking of this as World War, you know, three or four or whatever is wrong in a couple of respects. I do think that it overstates. You know, it overstates the threat, because this, you know, these people have managed to take over a couple of states in the Middle East. But, you know, the weapons of mass destruction is a wild card that wasn't there in World War II days. And that's something obviously to pay a lot of attention to. But as a political movement, they've not managed to attach themselves to a really big, powerful country the way Nazism or Soviet communism did. And also, I think the appeal is almost exclusively to other Muslims. It's really not to people in the West itself. So it's really a different kind of movement from the radical ones that we faced in the 20th century. And I think the rhetoric about war then tends to drive a lot of things like, making excuses for prisoner abuse or domestic eavesdropping, saying, well, we're at war, and then you do these things when you're at war. I think, you know, this is going to be a long-term struggle, but it's going to be a lower-level kind of struggle. We didn't accept these kinds of compromises with our principles during the Cold War, although we referred to it as a war, but it really was this long twilight struggle. And I think a war is something really different, where you are fighting at full intensity and it's got a clear beginning and a clear ending.
Chris is calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to ask Professor Fukuyama, the neocons are currently pushing for war with Iran. What can we do to stop it?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that if you asked most neoconservatives about whether they think there's a real military option, a lot of them would tell you that they don't believe there is. Now, I know Bill Kristol hasn't really spelled out what he thinks that option is, but he's been arguing that we may not have any choice and so forth. And I think that, what we need to do is, unlike before Iraq, we need to have a really full debate about this. We need to have a debate about what the nature of the regime is, what the real dangers. I mean, I think that there are, very real dangers in Iran getting a nuclear weapon, but I think that also it's not the same as a crazy terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda getting a nuclear weapon. And so we need to, we need to unpack that. We need to think very carefully and have a very, I think, reasonable debate or reasoned debate about why military options, what their limits are and what they would look like and, how they might proceed, because that's the way I think you get to the conclusion, which I believe in, that we actually don't have any good options with regard to Iran right now, neither diplomacy nor military nor, regime change through democracy promotion.
Do you think that full debate is more likely before an action against Iran than it was against Iraq?
Well, I don't think that the administration is on any fast track to undertake anything, because I suspect that they also think that none of their options look terribly good. And I think the danger is that they will have boxed themselves into a position where they feel they have to do something, since they said, well, we can't tolerate an Iranian nuclear program going forward. But I think we've got a lot of time before they get to that point. And I think that debate really needs to happen right now.
Morrill is calling from Columbus, Georgia. Hi, Morrill. You're on the air.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen.
Hello. What do you think?
I have two really quick questions. The first one is ideology of using the military might of America to spread democracy, and I was wondering if you guys could really discuss why we think that this is a valid way of spreading democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And second, a lot of times we hear the president throw around, we're going to fight them over there, so we're going to have to fight them over here. I'm wondering, are we developing a policy of deciding the value of life that somehow it is okay for the other side's innocence to be caught in the crosshairs, but it's not okay for ours?
Ooh, moral.
And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I'm just saying the idea of we're going to fight them over there, so we're going to fight them over here, is that too a valid policy?
There's a certain assumption embedded there. Moral, those are both great. Our time is really short. How about it, Francis Fukuyama? I mean, you're talking about realistic Wilsonianism. So what about military might and spreading democracy?
Well, first of all, the United States has never invaded countries simply to spread democracy. It's always been for security reasons, and we did it for a security reason in the Iraq case as well. The democracy comes as a kind of added benefit, and it did happen in Germany and Japan after 1945. I mean, that's not why we occupied them, but we did develop democratic institutions there. But I think, as a general rule, military force is not, it's not a very good instrument. As Bismarck said, you can do everything with bayonets, but sit on them. Mm-hmm. And the question of fighting them over there is, I think, just ridiculous. They wouldn't be fighting. I mean, these are Iraqis fighting American troops occupying their country, and to simply call that terrorism and to say that these people would be over here attacking Americans is just, confusing two really very different kinds of issues. And so I think we're actually creating, more terrorism as a result of the occupation.
Jack Beatty, Francis Fukuyama speaks softly, but he carries a pretty big stick. He's saying America has forfeited its moral standing on this neocon beam and exposed military weakness. That's a tall accusation.
It really is, and I think he makes a very strong and sober case for that. And I hope the book has influence in that regard. On the broader question of neoconservatism, it may be, I have written this, and I think it may happen, that neoconservative will come to be like isolationist, the word for people who are just wrong, who got history wrong, and whom time has passed. And I suspect that in future years, if people say, let's have some neoconservative advisors, that's even with Republican presidents, that's not going to bring on, let's do it. Because I do think that they were so wrong, so fundamentally wrong. and yet wrong off a pretty good base of assumptions. As Mr. Fukuyama points out, the things they believe in sound like basic Americanism. We believe in democracy. Mm. We're distrustful of international organizations. We don't like social engineering. But boy, did they get it wrong.
Francis Fukuyama, we've got 20 seconds. In a word, is it over? Neoconservatism.
I'm not sure it's quite as dead as Jack Beattie thinks, but I do think they've got work to do to reconstruct their image.
To say the least, by your account, Francis Fukuyama's new book is America at the Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy. Professor Fukuyama, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jack Beattie, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.